Okay, good evening everyone. Welcome to our next God's Grand Design. After tonight, we'll have three classes left. This is part 11, and we're going to be answering this question. How did the Grand Canyon form? A couple housekeeping things. How many of you saw the Ark in the Darkness movie? I thought it was pretty well done. My family and I enjoyed it. If you have any questions or comments after watching the movie, I would love to discuss it with you. So feel free to discuss it afterward. And as I was watching the movie, I thought, well, we need to do a lecture on catastrophic plate tectonics. I was going to skip it, but then as we watched it, I was like, oh, we should do it. So next class, we're going to get into earthquakes and volcanoes and mountains and plate tectonics and all that. So one more housekeeping thing. If you're new, get on the class email list. Send me an email, and I will add you to the list. But I would like to start with some prayer. Lord, we thank you for tonight. We ask that you would bless this class, that you would speak through me, that you would teach everyone here, Lord, that this night would honor you, you would increase our love for you and our respect for you, and we say all this in your name. Amen. So I got one general comment. This is important before we start getting into some of the more technical things the next couple lectures. There's a big difference between verses and models. So what do I mean? Here's a verse. It says in Genesis chapter 6, it tells us the boat is this long and this wide and this high. That's what the verse says. There's all kinds of models on what the boat actually looked like. Those are just models. Those aren't in the Bible. There's no photos in the Bible. Here's another example. Genesis 7, it says, in this year, in this month, on this day, the fountains of the deep burst forth. That gets into different models like the canopy model, hydroplate theory model, catastrophic plate tectonics model. So there's different models among Christians on how this process might have worked. Another example, Genesis 7 says, the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. There's different models on how the geological column was formed, or the flood boundary, or the supercontinent model, which we'll get into next week. And then Genesis 8, the fountains of the deep and the windows of the heaven were closed. And again, there's different erosional models, different models on how the Grand Canyon was formed. So all of the young earth creation guys, they all agree that God flooded the earth. But as you read and study all the different books, you'll start to see different takes on, like, well, this is how my model works. So you will realize that you're starting to understand the subject when you start to see differences in models. So I just want you to all understand before we get really scientific the next few weeks, there's no verses that say this is how the Grand Canyon was formed exactly. It's just a model. Do we understand that? All right, so here's our overview slide, just to review. View one, we're contrasting these two views of origins. God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, thousands of years ago. That's what this class is all about. View two, the heavens and earth evolved without God millions and billions of years ago. That's the dominant view of our world. And then this is our kind of our flood theology paragraph. It's worth reading again. There was a time when the entire world was covered with water as a result of a year-long flood. This was a judgment from God on all human and land dwelling life. It resulted in the death of all humans and animals who were not in the ark during the flood, based on Genesis 6 through 9, which we talked about in class 9. I'm going to review a couple slides here real quick because these are new concepts for us. It's important to see it again, and it's laying the framework for where we're going right now. So again, geology is a study of the Earth's physical structures, its history, and the processes that form them. So this is a surficial geological map of Utah, and all those different beautiful colors are all different kinds of rock that are all over our state. So there's this history, as we look at this map, that tells us how all of these rock layers were deposited and eroded, and there's two very different views that explain even the surface of our beautiful state. And then here's our chart again that contrasts the two different views. But I want to focus in on this illustration down here at the bottom. So everybody's looking at the valley with the river. But in the slow, gradual, uniformitarian model, there was a river that's been flowing for hundreds of millions or billions of years, and it's eroded this canyon, and this is what we see. But in the rapid, catastrophic model, at some point during the flood, there was this incredible flow of water that roared through, eroded out this canyon, and the river is basically like an orphan river that just happens to flow through that canyon. So that's sort of a pictorial representation of the two views and how we're both looking at the same real world valley, but there's two very different views to explain how the valley was formed. And then I'm going to review our Steno's laws or geological laws just very quickly. We talked about this last time. Superposition, if you have a stack of layers, the oldest layer is the layer at the bottom. And then lateral continuity, if you have an erosional feature, we would know that these different layers at one point were connected here, they've been eroded out. And then original horizontality, if we see layers that are tilted, we know originally they were deposited flat and then they've been tilted through earthquakes and uplifting, and then cross-cutting relationships. If we have something like this igneous intrusion that cuts through the layers, we know that this event had to happen after these layers. So it's important you know those. And then this is the big slide. If there's anything I want you to take away from last class's lecture, it's this observation here that 75% of the planet is covered with 1 mile of sedimentary rock. That's the most important thing that you should take out of last week's class. Remember, sedimentary rock is a mix of sand and gravel and silts and clays that were deposited in water and they cement together. It's sedimentary rock. And again, 3/4 of the continents of our planet have a mile of sedimentary rock on them. So last class, we talked about 5 evidences for the flood in the geological column. We talked about a lack of erosion between the layers, that these layers spread across continents. We talked about cross bedding. We talked about the large cobbles and boulders carried in these layers. And then we talked about the soft sediment deformation. That was a good lecture, wasn't that? That was so enjoyable. All right. That is right. So last class, we talked about basically how the pancakes got stacked, the deposition of the geological column. This class, we're going to talk about how the pancakes got eroded or cut away, okay? So that's where we're going in this class. So in the flood model, you've got 150 days where the floodwaters were advancing or flooding up over the continents, and then 220 days where they were retreating or draining off the continents, eroding the continents. So this is sort of the depositional part where all those layers are deposited, and then this is the erosional part where those layers were eroded out. And so that's kind of a timeline based on Genesis. So we could break down the flood into these 4 phases. The deposition of the sedimentary rock, plate tectonics, that's where mountains are going up and valleys are dropping. And then sheet flow erosion happening through this phase, and then channelized erosion as you get down here. So I'm going to do this in a totally ridiculous order. We talked about number 1 last week. We're going to talk about 3 and 4 this week, and we're going to go back to number 2 next time. So, makes perfect sense. That's how we're going to do it. So, a preview for next time, we're going to go into plate tectonics. We're going to talk about how the continents are formed and the ocean floor and earthquakes and volcanoes. We're going to talk about runaway plate tectonics and the valleys getting pushed up and why there's marine fossils on the tops of mountains. So that's where we're going. I was going to skip it, but then I watched that movie and I was like, most of us saw it. It teased it all out. We'll just go here. So that's where we're going. So let's go back to this slide. We're going to start with number 3. Sheet flow erosion, or wide sheets of water eroding the Earth's surface. And when I say erosion, I think you all know what I mean, but it's the geological process in which earthen materials are worn away and transported by natural forces such as water or wind. So when we look at the surface of our planet, we ask ourselves, when we look at the erosion, do we see slow, gradual processes or sudden, catastrophic erosional processes? So I want to talk about this sheet of water draining off the continents. So as the floodwaters are receding, there's a giant sheet of water draining off of the continents. And they planed things off all over the place. So here's a technical definition. It's called planation surfaces. Mountains and hills have been planed off into flat features by retreating floodwaters. So we have our layers. We have a fault. This part's been pushed up. It's been deformed by the earth movement. And then the floodwaters have scoured the top of this mountain flat. They've planed it off. So, do we see planation surfaces? We see them all over the planet. Here's one in Canada. You can see the top of that is planed totally flat. Here's one in Wyoming. Here's one in Ethiopia. Here's one in Australia. Here's one in Arizona. That's the Grand Canyon. You should know that one. Here's Montana. And again, we're looking at the top of this mountain has just been planed off, totally flat. Here's another one in Wyoming. Again, we see the top of the mountain has been planed off flat. So you see these all over the planet. I think I read that 40% of Africa is a planation surface. So you would assume that the old Earth geological community has a great explanation for why there are planed off mountains and hills all over the Earth. Let's read a few quotes. This guy's name is Krikme. This is the first half of the quote. He says, "Such landscape as flat-topped hills or high plateaus shows no process in action that might favor or maintain its flatness. Consequently, one cannot say that any geological work now observable has made it as flat as it is. The completion of its flattening appears to have been in the past. All this evidence tends to indicate unity and simple design among these flat surfaces and to encourage the hope that the business of seeking the origin, their origin, is not little problems, but a major problem." In other words, they see them all over. They're not quite sure what formed them. And geomorphology just means earth change. So he studies how the earth changes. And then these guys wrote a book on geomorphology. They said, "The existence of planation surfaces is asserted by a host of writers, yet few attempt any serious explanation of their development. It is perplexing that after a century of argument and observation of the continents, no generally accepted mechanism for planation has been forthcoming." In other words, we're not sure what planed all these mountains off. And that's a problem. But for the flood geologists, planation surfaces make perfect sense. So that's our first evidence for a flood that we see erosionally, that there are planation surfaces all over the planet. As you drive around Utah, you can see hills and mountains that just have a flat top. And you go, something planed that off, and the retreating waters coming off the continents and sheet flows are a fantastic mechanism to explain planation surfaces. So I'm going to play a clip for you where Del Tackett is interviewing Dr. Steve Austin. Kristen and I met Del Tackett on Saturday. We were in the Grand America Hotel walking around the lobby, and I saw this pastor guy I know, and I said, "Hey, what are you doing here?" And he said, "I just heard Del Tackett talk." I was like, "Del Tackett is in the building?" And so Kristen and I ran over to this conference room, ran into the room. He just wrapped up his lecture. We shook his hand and took a picture with Del Tackett. So check that off the bucket list. So Del Tackett is talking to Steve Austin, who's a geologist, and they're talking about how powerful water is. So you guys, in 1980, some of you were not born, some of you remember this, in 1980, Mount St. Helens erupted. This huge catastrophe, this huge volcanic eruption, through lots of ash and dust and debris flows and water and mud. So this is a 4-minute clip of Del Tackett interviewing Dr. Steve Austin about how much sediment was deposited during Mount St. Helens. So listen for how much the thickness of sediment.
May 18th, 17 seconds after 8:32 in the morning, there was a big earthquake, magnitude 5.1. It shook the north slope of the mountain. The over-steepened and cracked north slope began to slide. It formed this gigantic rock fall that became mixed with atmosphere and gas and dispersed, and it became a debris avalanche. And this debris avalanche overtopped this ridge and went 10 miles from the volcano. And then behind that avalanche, the pressure inside the volcano was released, and super hot liquid water in the neck of the volcano expanded to steam, and it created this gigantic steam explosion, equivalent to 20,000 tons of TNT blast energy. That was directed not up, but northward over the landscape. And then we had the debris avalanche going into Spirit Lake, and the avalanche displaced the water of the lake up to 860 feet, creating this enormous or giant water wave on the lake. And then following that were mud flows. The heat of the explosion melted the snow and the ice around the volcano, and we had mud flows on six major rivers downstream. And then we had pyroclastic flows, especially on the afternoon of May 18th. The volcano erupted episodically, these frothed up liquid flows that came out. And then to follow the rest of the day, there was airfall debris. We call that the pumice that fell out of the atmosphere. We call that airfall tephra. So that's the kind of the story of the 9-hour eruption on May 18th.
There was a lot going on that day.
Yes.
See, when we were walking up here, you were telling me that before 1980, if we look down there, we would see a lush forest, but it's a whole lot lower than what we see. This has all been filled in. What happened? How did all the material get here, and what did we learn from it?
Well, we have a lot of deposits, don't we? There's up to 600 feet of deposits here in this valley. It was sky before the eruption, and now look what's going on down there. Okay, that is an amazing thing, just thinking about that. So a lot of the deposition, up to 600 feet of deposits, and then the way the erosion has occurred in this area, it allows the layers to be exposed, and so we can see the sequence of events that formed not just this ridge, but the valley. Mm-hmm. Some of these events occurred as much as 2 or 3 years after the 1980 eruption. And every event left a fingerprint of something here on the landscape. So we have Earth's newest landscape, and we have all the knowledge from eyewitnesses and from photographs to put together the sequence of events here at the volcano.
So we have mud flows, we have pyroclastic flows, we have these explosion pits, we have erosion, and we look out here and we see there's a lot of character to this land.
Yes.
But it all occurred rapidly through these catastrophic events.
Yes.
What does that tell a geologist who now moves their vision from what happened here at Mount St. Helens and then begins to look around the world at the geological formations we have around the world?
That's my story, is I came here and I'm looking around elsewhere and I see the application of erosion and deposition and those kind of processes that are here at the volcano to many other features of the Earth's surface.
So how much deposition?
600
feet, right. Let's have Steve Austin talking about erosion. This one's 2 minutes long.
When a mud flow itself, when it's still saturated with a lot of that material, can it be erosive itself?
Always, very erosive. And that's what was observed here. Okay, the mud flows came by and they picked up bridges and just floated bridges now. Logs, everything, it floats, okay? And so an automobile floats on a mud flow. They freight things along, okay? And we chuckle at thinking about how mud moves things, and I'm sure the people involved in the disaster of the moving mud don't like what they're seeing, but it is obvious that we need to think this way about the process.
Can a mud flow also cut down rather than just go through bridges or collect bridges and so forth? Can it also cut down in below?
Yes, and now mud is seen to do that on the slopes of Mount St. Helens. The two canyons on the north slope of the volcano are very deep. Step Canyon is over 600 feet deep, eroded through solid rock, made by moving mud after the summer of 1980. And there's another canyon called Lewitt Canyon, where it's over 100 feet deep, eroded through solid rock. 500-year-old lava flow. It didn't take tens of thousands of years to do that. It was basically mud moving down that channel very rapidly, plucking away and grabbing solid rock. And excavating a canyon.
So how much erosion? 600 feet. So we have one catastrophic event that deposits 600 feet of sediment and erodes 600 feet through solid bedrock. It is a powerful demonstration of the power of water and catastrophe to retool the surface of our planet. And again, one volcano, one state. Imagine if the entire planet had catastrophic flows of water and debris and sediment and volcanic activity, which we'll get into next time. So let's move on to our second piece of evidence, massive planetary erosion. So again, we're looking at evidences for the flood in erosion tonight. We're going to talk about erosion now on a scale that boggles your brain. If you think about what I'm about to show you, your mind should be blown. So, first of all, these are all in Utah and Arizona. I kept them all local. So, this is the San Rafael Swell down by Green River. So here's our geological cross-section. So originally the layers were deposited horizontally. They were lifted here, and then all of these layers were just eroded away. So you could be driving by this on a car down here, and you'd have no idea what you're looking at. But we get up here in an airplane, and we look at it. These are slabs of rock, hundreds of feet thick. They're just sticking up into the sky, and everything is just gone. It's all been eroded away. But wait, there's more. This is Water Pocket Fold in Capitol Reef National Park. Again, see the road. If you're driving on this road, you'd be like, oh, those are pretty. But here's the geological cross-section, again, deposited horizontally, tipped through uplift, and then all of that rock that's lightly shaded is all gone. So everything, all these layers just go to space, and everything that they were connected to is gone. It's just all been swept away. Here's the virgin anticline. Anticline is just like a bulge. So again, these layers were laid down flat. They were lifted up. And then as the floodwaters were going over the top, it erodes out. And now that we're all geological experts, we know that originally all of these layers were connected. So here's another airplane view. This is, again, St. George. These arrows highlight where the layers were connected. So everything that bridged over the top of this is gone. There's another one, the Wasatch Mountains. This is kind of where we're going next time, but you can see the layers of rock. They're sedimentary, they're metamorphic, they've been bent, twisted, pushed up, and then eroded away. You can see the horizontal lines. Doug sent me a photo of just the horizontal lines that are so obvious as we look at our mountains. So, and then Zach sent me this photo. I believe this is the Alps. Just this incredible deformation of these layers as these mountains were pushed up and eroded. And then our Uinta Mountains. So again, we see the sedimentary rock on the sides. We see the crack where the faulting happened. And then you have the uplift where the mountains are pushed up and all the rock that should be over, all the sedimentary rock that should be over the Uinta Mountains is all gone. It's all been washed away. So we have the sedimentary rock on the edge, and then you have the quartzites, the basement rocks in the middle, and then finally, our last example, this is Grand Staircase. So just so you get your bearings, here's Bryce, here's Zion, here's the Grand Canyon. So this would be Utah moving down into Arizona. So now we know that all these layers were all deposited one at a time, and then all of the layers that are missing here were all eroded away. And these dashed lines kind of give you an idea. One, I think we saw in a video a few classes ago, one of the guys said there's like 10,000 feet of rock that's just gone here. It's all been carried away. And then it channelized and cut through the Grand Canyon. So again, we talked about last time how the layers were stacked. Now we're talking about how they were carried away. But where's all the material gone? So let's compare our two models again. This is the hydrological map of Utah. This is a map of all the rivers and drainage basins in our state. According to the Old Earth Evolutionary View, this network of rivers and streams over hundreds of millions and billions of years has eroded away all of that sediment that is in our state, one sand grain at a time. But in the catastrophic global flood model, we're talking, again, about a year-long flood with 150 days of advancing water, 220 days of retreating water that is pulverizing the surface of our planet, depositing all those layers, and then eroding them away. It's God's watery judgment of our Earth. And again, the water would have flown off in two phases, a giant sheet of water planing things off, and then as the water got lower, it starts to channelize and cut out canyons. Let's go back to my new favorite photo, Monument Valley, again down on the Utah-Arizona border. So again, in our flood model, all of these layers of rock at one time were connected. I drew some horizontal lines there so you can see where the different seams connect with each other. And then all of the rock that was between these was carried away. And it's gone. Like, you can't see it. There's not random rocks and debris, and It's just all gone. So these layers were deposited, and then they were scoured away, except for these three, which are just standing there as like sentinels. And that's about 1,000 feet from the top of that butte down to the valley floor there. Water is that powerful. So I got another video. This is some kid's science video. I think it's fantastic, so I'm going to play it. So this is Glen Canyon Dam. In 1983, there was a ton of rain and a ton of snow, and the Glen Canyon Dam filled up. It almost overtopped. The hydrological engineers were concerned that the whole dam might fail, so they're trying to emerge it. Let's just watch the video. So, some kid talking about it.
1983, the Colorado River went into flood stage, filling Lake Powell at 148,000 cubic feet of water per second. Glen Canyon Dam was in danger of overflowing. The power plant was running at full capacity, moving 28,000 cubic feet of water per second through the turbines. Engineers opened the four outlet tubes, which increased the flow by 17,000 cubic feet of water per second, but much more was needed. The 40-foot diameter tunnel spillway was opened, and the flow was eventually increased to 32,000 cubic feet of water per second.
Scientists were aware of cavitation, a dangerous process where water can tear through almost any material and surface when enough pressure and flow is taking place.
Engineers were worried that this much flow could destroy the spillway tunnel if opened too much. Their worst fears were realized when the outgoing water became red and the ground started to shake. They saw huge pieces of bedrock and concrete being hurled into the air at the bottom of the tunnel. This all happened in just a few minutes. They quickly shut down the spillway and went in to investigate. What they found totally surprised them. The 3-foot-thick concrete steel-reinforced tunnel had been penetrated by pits. The sides of the tunnel were missing, and the rebar was torn into pieces. Where the elbow was near the bottom, there was a giant hole 32 feet deep, 40 feet wide, and 150 feet long. Estimates were that cavitation destroyed the tunnel at 1,000 cubic feet per second during the peak. How did this happen? When water comes down a surface at high pressure and flow, if it hits an uneven surface, the water is thrown upward by the obstruction, which causes a partial vacuum and a vapor cavity develops, which starts to wear away at the surface. Once a pit is made, it causes more upward waves, which makes more pits, and then begins a leapfrog process of erosion. The tunnel had to be quickly repaired. It took 63,000 cubic feet of concrete to fill.
This shows us that with enough water flow and pressure, cavitation can create huge erosional features in just a short amount.
Such a good video. If there's any point, you should just see is water is super powerful. Water can do incredibly destructive things. So here's a couple quick examples of more erosional things. This is Providence Canyon State Park in Georgia. This is a man-made canyon. In the 1800s, the farmers were not watering their fields right, and it eroded out this canyon that's 150 feet deep very quickly. This is up in Washington State. This is Burlingame Canyon. This is 1,500 feet long, and they were building some irrigation canals. Mistakes were made, and this was eroded out in 6 days. This canyon was eroded out that quickly. And then in 2017, when I was on that rafting trip down the Grand Canyon, they took us up this side canyon here. They wanted to hike us up to this rock to see these very unusual fracture patterns. They called it, Dr. Snelling called it concordial fractures. I'm right here in the black shirt. Anyway, this is basically, there's overburden confining pressures on this sandstone, and it was eroded out so rapidly that the bedrock is like failing like in a catastrophic way. So this is basically, I could explain this to you better afterward, but I'm going to move on. Basically, it was eroded out so quickly that it was releasing stress in a catastrophic way. It didn't erode normally. So let's talk a little bit more about channelized flow. So as the water gets, first initially, it's moving off the continents in these big, massive sheets of water forming planation surfaces. And now C, our third point, as the water levels continue to drop, now it's starting to erode canyons. The narrow currents form major land features that we see. So we're going to watch a video talking about one possible model to explain the formation of the Grand Canyon. There's some creation geologists who think the Grand Canyon formed while water was receding off the earth during the flood. Some think there was an inland lake and it happened after. That's the theory that Austin is going to present right here. But again, this is that idea versus model. So this is a model to explain how the Grand Canyon was formed. I think it's a reasonable model.
This was all covered with that lake. We call it Opie Lake, and it comes up to a natural dam up here. Yeah, at this point you're talking about. And that's where at some point, for some reason, it breached. It just gave way, or maybe an earthquake or something. Just overtopping of a natural earth dam can create spillway erosion. And there's no such thing as slow failure of a natural dam in spillover. When spillover erosion occurs on a natural dam, it erodes rapidly. Where do you think this is occurring in terms of the flood? I'd like to think of it as post-flood. The rock is already hardened. The monocline has already been flexed. The uprump has occurred. The rocks are hardened. And then the overtopping and spillway erosion of the solid rock.
So this could be
hundreds of years after floods, possibly.
How many different lakes are we talking about?
There may be three or four different lakes associated with the Grand Canyon itself. So above Lee's Ferry in the Lake Powell area, Copper Ridge Plateau, behind that another lake, that could fail. My view is the lakes failed from the top down. The spillover of this Hopi Lake over the Kaibab upward into the next basin below it created what? Another lake below it, and that would be Turoweek Lake. The drainage basins upstream filled first, and they spilled, destroyed their dams by spillway erosion, and they drained to the west. And you created the Grand Canyon by top-down failing of dams into lowland areas. So the erosion is channeled to form a canyon. Okay, it's a straight canyon, but yeah, it's channelized. And that is what we see. So we see erosion in channels by spillover, it looks like. And so the lake didn't take millions of years to drain. It didn't take millions of years for the Colorado River to erode the Grand Canyon.
So I think it is a model with a lot of explanatory power, but nobody was standing there with a camera. So that's just an animation, right? We all understand that. So if you're paying attention, you're wondering, well, where did all of this sediment and rock and sand and gravel go? Where did all of this incredible amount of rock that got eroded off our continent go? Well, it went into the continental shelves. There is a continental shelf around every continent on the planet. Again, here are a couple things to highlight. The scale vertically is exaggerated significantly so we can see the features. You see there's a shelf, there's a slope, there's a rise. And let me see the dimensions here. It's anywhere from 9 to 12 miles thick. Right there, and it's about 300 miles long. YouTube knows that I'm really into geology right now, so it's suggesting all of these geology videos. So this is a screenshot. This is the continental shelf. All of that sediment washing off the continents, just depositing right on the edge of the continents. This geologist has freehand sketched this. This is Mount Everest, which is about 5.5 miles high. He's basically just showing the sediment on the edge of the continents is so thick that you could just drop Mount Everest there, and it would totally be buried in the sediment. So again, you see the sheet flows would have deposited this, and then as the water got lower, you see that submarine canyon. We're going to come back to this when we get into the Ice Age in a couple lectures, but Where's all the sediment? It's off the coast of all the continents. It's in the ocean. You see it around all the continents, but here's North America, because that's where we are right now. So you see that area, that's the expansion around our continent. That's the continental shelf. That's the sediment that's washed out into the ocean. This is basically what the ocean would look like if you drained all of the water. So let's move on to our fourth evidence for the flood that we see in the erosional layers. We're going to talk about rounded boulders. So if the Earth was old, you would expect this. You would, based on uniformitarian assumptions, you would expect hard rock layers to still be there, but soft layers would have eroded out. But interestingly, many times what we see is that both the hard layer and the soft layer have been scoured off flat. We talked about that, the planation surfaces. But then across the top of many of these surfaces, there's rounded boulders. And what is interesting, when you study these boulders, here's some close-ups, there's a few things you should know. One, the size of the rocks, there's these percussion or impact marks on these rounded boulders. They have determined that some of these rocks were carried up to 800 feet from their source. We're talking about flows of water sheeting off the continents that are so significant that they're picking up and moving boulders that big. The boulders are crashing into each other. Based on the collisions, they've estimated that the rocks were moving at 60 to 70 miles an hour. So we have incredible flow carrying these boulders and depositing them. I want to talk about the erosion rate of the continents. So old Earth geologists estimate that the current erosion of our continents is about 40 feet per million years, which is really slow. I read a couple articles even today that said our continents would be gone at this rate in anywhere from 10 to 20 million years, and yet we're told our continents are hundreds of millions of years old. Utah is like 4,000 feet above sea level. At 40 feet per million years, our whole state would be gone in like 100 million years, and it's way older than that. So anyway, let's illustrate this with Hawaii. They have measured the erosion rate of Hawaii, which is Hawaii is getting smaller at 5 inches per year due to erosion. So here's Dr. Tim Clary, a geologist, talking about Hawaii's erosion.
In some ways, Hawaii is even more interesting because you get these islands up there. They're supposed to be, Kauai is supposed to be around 5 million years old. I think Maui is supposed to be 2 or 3 million years old. Oahu is somewhere around 4. Give or take a little bit. But they're very small islands. And he measured the erosion rate since 1900 on the beaches, the beach erosion, which really is the erosion. The beach erosion on the islands of Hawaii, several islands, is about 0.4 feet per year, about 5 inches per year. And so, it doesn't seem like a lot. The islands are getting smaller every year by about 5 inches all around.
And if they're millions of years old.
And if they're millions of years old, it's, I think that's something 76 miles in 1 million years.
How big are they?
Aren't that big.
Yeah.
And so there should be no islands at all. There should be no islands at that rate, which has been measured for over 100 years now.
Yeah, that's good. So the big idea right here is that at the current erosion rates, all the land features we see should be long gone in millions and hundreds of millions of years. Here's one more example of the power of erosion. This is Chimney Rock in western Nebraska. I don't know if you guys have ever been there. Here on the left is a photo from when pioneers were going by way back in the day. Many of the Utah Mormon pioneers went on the wagon train by this place, Chimney Rock. This is what it looks like today. And you can see visibly, here's the jump right there. You see the spire has changed even in the last 100, 150 years. It's eroded down. So erosion is happening way quickly, even on our planet. Our final piece of evidence is water and wind gaps, our fifth piece of evidence. So what is a water or wind gap? So when the waters were receding off the earth and they are eroding down the surface, they cut these gaps, and then the water level will be below the gap. See here? The water, the river, it may go through it or it may not. If it's just wind going through it, they call it a wind gap. But if there's some huge, massive cut in this mountain, there's a little river going through it, they call it a water gap. And again, there are features that scream at some point there was something massive flowing between these mountains that gouged out that wind or water gap. The flood can easily explain these. They're all over the place. Here's a few examples of them. This is Devil's Gate, Wyoming. You see that break right there in the rock? The river could have easily gone around it, but it cut right through that area. Now, why would a river go through a mountain? Doesn't make a lot of sense. Here's Cody, Wyoming. There's this giant gap in this mountain. This is 2,500 feet of elevation change, and there's a little tiny stream right there. But why does a stream go through a mountain? This is a remnant of water sheeting off the continent, eroding that out, a water gap. Here's another example. This is Split Mountain. This is the Green River by Vernal. Aiden and I rafted it. These are my two rafting trips. I'm not like rafting all the time. You guys have now seen photos of my two rafting trips. So, Aiden right here, you see this rock? We're just right there. So for some reason, this river came here and it cut through a mountain and it continued on its way when it could have just wrapped around the mountain. And so the theory and the creation model, the flood model, is that that is a remnant of when the water was sheeting off the continents and it was eroding out these channels, and these rivers are just finding these weak spots that were previously formed. And then one more, Delaware. This one's kind of wild. There's that ridge, and there's the river. Water doesn't go uphill. So we need a mechanism to get the water to cut through the mountain. Water's not going uphill to cut through mountains. We all know that. Water doesn't go uphill. All right. If you loved this lecture on geomorphology, you should read Flood by Design by Mike Ord. It's a fantastic book. So here are five evidences again. Planation service, massive planetary erosion, channelized flow, rounded boulders, water and wind gaps. So I'll end with this. What is this a photo of? This is like you see on a beach, sand ripples, right? So do you see the sand ripples in this photo? This is western Nebraska. So you see them right there? I zoom in on Google Earth and then I rotate our perspective looking up into like South Dakota. So look at this. Across the slope. Nebraska has no slopes. So here they are side by side. There's a beach and there's western Nebraska. And you see the sand ripples. So we can hear this lecture and go, whoa, the Earth was flooded. That's crazy. But we can't miss the big E on the I chart. Can't miss the main point of all this. Our verse from the New Testament this week is 1 Peter chapter 3, the Apostle Peter. He says, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is 8 persons, were brought safely through the water. So the big idea as I conclude here is that in the same way the ark saved Noah and his family, Jesus Christ is our salvation. So don't walk out of this class being like, man, the earth was flooded. That's step one. I have confidence in the Bible. Step two is God came to the earth and he died on the cross to save us. And like the same way Noah and his family got in the ark, we need to accept Jesus as our Lord and Savior. Amen? Amen. All right. We've got 15 minutes. Let's discuss these questions. Thank you.